DW WorldLink.
Welcome to DW's WorldLink, bringing you the personal stories. I'm Kathleen Schuster in Bonn, Germany. On this week's show, the language believed to have been spoken by Christ is on the verge of extinction. We talk to the man who's trying to save it.
What does it mean, the death of a language? It's very much like biodiversity in plants. The loss of one thing damages the rest.
And strides in education could transform one of Africa's worst war zones. We speak with an expert in South Sudan.
And then he said a very good thing. He said, look, we are not the people who are living in these tents. You know, we are refugees who take refuge in books.
That and more coming up on WorldLink. You're listening to DW's WorldLink with me, Kathleen Schuster. There's an ethnic group in the Middle East known as Assyrians, that's Assyrians with an A, which has found itself fleeing war and persecution in recent years. They're also among the last speakers of an ancient language called Surat. Now, Surat might not ring a bell, but perhaps Aramaic does. Aramaic, as in the language believed to have been spoken by Christ 2,000 years ago. What Assyrians speak now is a modern version of that. For DW, Freddie Chick went to meet an Assyrian in exile who is trying to save his language and the ancient culture it contains.
When you go to the British Museum, and when you go to the ancient Near Eastern section and see all these cuneiform, you know, wedge-like scripts written on the walls and the tablets, that is either Sumerian or Akkadian.
And so the Aramaic, what should people think of there? What is
well,
that language?
Well, the language of Christ, for example.
So this language goes back to the language that we think Jesus would have actually just spoken?
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Ah, hello.
Hey, how are you, Freddie?
Hello. Hey. Yes, nice to meet you.
Nice to see you,
One autumn Sunday morning, I rode my bike past the world-famous University of Cambridge in England and then out across muddy fields to visit Nineb in his home.
My name is Nineb Lamassu. I am an Assyrian born in Iraq, fled Iraq in 86. I ended up here in England, Cambridge. This is where I really call home now.
Nineb is an Assyrian whose mother tongue is northeastern New Aramaic, or Surat, as it is called by its speakers. It's one of the oldest living languages in the world. Its roots reach back to the millennia before Christ, when the Assyrian Empire stretched across what is now Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, parts of Turkey, Iran, and Egypt. And now the language is dying. There are only a few hundred thousand speakers left, and many of them are refugees of war spread thinly across the world, unable to pass their language on. As well as trying to save his mother tongue, Nineb is on the track of a cultural treasure that has been passed down for thousands of years by his people's bards.
The first time I was exposed to this tradition was when I was living as a refugee in Iran. I still remember it like it was today. There was an Assyrian bard. He's still alive and he's in New Zealand. His name is Khenenya Zaya. In the refugee camps, our sole form of entertainment was him. And I remember as kids, we would go around looking, search the tents. We would know his shoes. And if the tent was full already with people, then we would, be it cold, be it raining, we would be squeezing ourselves next to the tent with the hope of hearing as much as we could. It was captivating. It was really, I still remember it like it was today.
Years later, and Nineb was in London listening to a lecture on ancient Assyria. The lecturer was discussing Gilgamesh, the 4,000-year-old epic about a king who is one-third man and two-thirds god. It is revered for being the oldest story on earth. Suddenly, childhood memories of the bard Khenenya Zaya began flooding back to Nineb.
I thought, hang on a sec, there are similarities here.
It had been assumed that the storytelling tradition which gave birth to the Gilgamesh epic died out long ago. No one had really investigated for its survival, and yet Nenib was sure there were echoes of Gilgamesh in the stories his bard had told him. It hinted at an unbroken oral tradition that had survived for 4,000 years. Until now, that is.
Not only the language is endangered, but all the traditions, all the culture, all the literature associated with the language is dying out. So basically, I am hunting down, not to kill, the few remaining bards that know the epic. And that bard tradition, it's on the verge of disappearing. In recent times, let's talk about ISIS. Around 34 Assyrian villages, fully populated in the Khabur River base in Syria, is now almost emptied of its people. The most dense populated area in northern Iraq, Assyrian populated area, was the Nineveh plain. You know, naturally, ancient Nineveh, ancient Assyria. ISIS, as you know, took over Mosul, which is ancient Nineveh, and then drove all the Assyrians, along with the Yazidis, out of the Nineveh plains and damaging the houses, burning them and reducing them to rubbles intentionally to make it harder, if not impossible, for these people to ever return.
Persecution in their homelands have scattered the Assyrian people across the world and left their language and culture on the brink of dying out. With the towns and villages the Surat language was spoken in now deserted, its survival is unlikely. But Nineb is doing what he can to keep his language alive. And this afternoon, he's teaching an online class of three diligent students of Surat.
The noun is an emphatic form, it's not in the construct. Today, I would like to tell you something. I've got someone from DW. Here we go. His name is Freddy.
Hello, everyone.
So anyone wants to volunteer to answer some questions?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes,
very
yes,
well, yes.
Great.
So, my name is Stan Shabazz. I'm of Assyrian background. My grandparents came to the U.S. Before World War I.
And so why are you studying the language?
I mean, as a third generation, a successful professional living in the U.S., why is it important for you to... Well, why do you need it? Why do you want to learn it?
Well, I think it's like a responsibility to keep it alive and to promote it. And like, if I can show, look, I'm studying it, it encourages other people, and also maybe I can help to teach other people. I think everyone has to pitch in and to learn it as much as they can.
What does it mean, the death of a language? You see, we are all connected. We all form the world civilization. You see, it's very much like biodiversity in plants. We need everything. The loss of one thing damages the rest.
For DW, this is Freddie Chick in Cambridge, England.
Turning now to Africa. South Sudan has had a peace deal in place since September. It's the latest of many attempts to end a civil war that has forced millions to flee their homes. Here's a quick refresher for listeners who might not be familiar with this story. South Sudan became a country in 2011 after gaining independence from Sudan. But within two short years, a political fallout between the president and his vice president sparked a conflict, which soon divided the entire country along ethnic lines. Fighting and famine have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives in the years since. It's still experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises in Africa, and foreign organizations say one way to solve it is through education. Sardar Umar Alam is one of those people. He heads UNESCO's office in Juba, where he spoke to me over Skype. My first question to him, why is education such a priority when the country has much bigger issues to deal with?
Education literally saves lives. And if you see who are the people who are most affected in this conflict, it are the children. And if you can bring understanding through education so that they can understand the context and can understand the suffering they are going through, they can come up with the solution, and they see education as a hope. Especially when you are going through children, when they go through the psychosocial problems and physical fatigue, They really need a space, safe spaces where they can come back and see a normalcy. Fine, it's not about knowing things. It's also about saving lives as well.
What do the South Sudanese who you've spoken with, what do they think about getting an education? Is this a priority for them?
I asked a teacher and I said, you are in a refugee camp, you know, and how you are living with your family. Even his wife was a rape victim and he lost his mother as well. And he was just taking care of his kids. And then he said a very good thing. He said, look, we are not the people who are living in these tents. You know, we are refugees who take refuge in books. And it shows that they have a faith in education, believing that this is something which they have realized can help them and can make them better understand their rights, and they can better understand that this is something which can give them not only jobs, but also give them skills. You know, I was in a village, and then they told me that, oh, let me introduce to you a girl. She's just 10 years old, and she saved like 10 or 12 babies in the village. What she did was that she went to school, and in this school, she learned to read fine. So that the whole village was affected by diarrhea. And in this culture, they were not giving liquids fine to their babies. So she read somewhere that oral dehydration solution is something which you can provide to the babies, and she knew how to make it. So she put six tablespoon of sugar and half a tablespoon of salt in 1 liter of bottle and gave it to all the mothers and the babies in the village and asked them to feed it. And she was the only person who can read and write in that 30-40 people population of village or small village. And when the health worker came, they said if she would not have provided this a liquid solution, rehydration solution, these babies would have passed away. So now they can understand that if you have a mother or a daughter and who is educated, or even a girl is educated, she really comes out and saves lives and can contribute. So they can see the value of education as well.
So I was wondering, is there a different approach in the outreach programs for girls and boys in South Sudan when it comes to making sure that they are able to read or they're getting the skills they need to help the country move forward?
We treat them equally, and certainly we have to take care of their rights as well, especially when it comes to girls in South Sudan. For example, just a few weeks back on a social media site, a girl was auctioned. And she was 16 or 15 years old, and she was given to the highest bidder for 500 cows and 3 Land Cruisers and $10,000 cash. But even in normal villages, this is going on. At 13 or 14, their parents sell them for 10 or 20 cows, or they are abducted or raped. And then once we have early child marriages, and then we have early pregnancies. So that is why whenever it comes to program, we have gender-based violence programs, we have more illiteracy programs, especially cash for work and cash assistance and stipends for girls. Education really works because we try to make sure that we pay the money or cash assistance to their parents or stipends to the girls so that they have economic like means to send their daughters to school and regularly monitor them.
What about for boys? It's a patriarchal society. So what is the focus then with making sure that boys are getting the education? And also, if I can tack this question on too, what is the expectation for the level of education that men need to be getting? Because, you know, the majority of South Sudanese are under the age of 30.
I think it's an excellent question. In many areas in South Sudan, we are facing a problem, which is cattle raiding. So these young people, especially boys in particular, because of the conflicts, there's such a prolonged conflict, there's a lot of small arms, so ammunition and finding guns and pistols and AK-47, which creates serious issue. Like a few months back, like 150 young people lost their job because of cattle raiding, and there are two young people who have guns in their hand and they start shooting each other. So for them, we have started a program, and what we are doing is that the teachers, we have given them tablets as books, and they move around these cattle camps.
Wait, can I interrupt you really quickly? How do they power the tablets out in the middle of nowhere?
I say, excellent question, solar power.
Ah, okay.
So middle of nowhere, we have given them solar power. You know, it's like, you can see, you know, when you talk about climate change and the renewable energies, these types of energies are life savings in settings like South Sudan, where you don't have electricity at all. So they not only teach them read and write, they teach them peace messages, how to manage their cattle, and how to make, instead of doing cattle raiding, how to use milk to sell. And even we have a mixed gathering where girls and boys, they come, and we have different discussion on social cohesions and like sexual and reproductive health, all different topics we discuss. So that sensitize them so they have a knowledge to not only take care of them well, but also to take care of their society.
I have heard that you're actually leaving Juba in the next few months and ending your time with UNESCO in South Sudan to move on to another post. And I was just wondering if you would like to share with us what your biggest achievement has been in South Sudan, looking back on your time there.
Really, you know, when I sleep at night, I have just across my wall, there are 40,000 what we call protection of civilian site is just across like some feet away from my room where people are sleeping under tents. And I really, when I see them, I said, okay, before I go, I see really see them, look how life can, how better my life is as compared to them, but still how strong human beings they are. And these are the people, frankly speaking, who are the one who make all of us work for them, and they get, and they are the one who bring best out of from us. So this is what I will take away from South Sudan.
Mr. Alam, I would like to thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
With internet access so essential to daily life in many countries these days, it's quite easy to forget that actually roughly half of the world's population is still offline. In Zimbabwe, there are three brothers who are taking matters into their own hands to bring the internet, and with it the world, to their community. Laura Zalm-Reifascheid has this report. It's presented by Anka Raspa.
If you look right around the lab, we have got only those desktops. There is need for speakers, projectors, whiteboards. Those are some of the resources which we do not have, and printers we do not have.
Memory Muwawa is an ICT teacher at Makumbe Central Primary School in a very remote part of the Buhera district in the Manicaland province of eastern Zimbabwe. The school buildings are surrounded by cornfields, dry shrubs and bush, 27 kilometers from Murambinda, the next town. The classroom floors are polished, the walls freshly painted, and the paths sneaking through the school grounds are well kept. While the school of around 280 pupils has an ICT lab, equipment is lacking. Often five or six pupils have to share one of the few computers, some of which are out of order. An even bigger challenge is the lack of textbooks.
Wi-Fi will need it for research. We do not have adequate resources like textbooks, which might give us the current information. If you look in some of our textbooks, they are of the old age, they are of long back. So if we have Wi-Fi, we will be talking of the current things which are happening in day-to-day life.
However, providing internet to rural, sparsely populated areas is often not economically attractive to large internet and telecommunications companies. So optical fiber infrastructure is typically inadequate in the countryside. The cost of satellite connections is well beyond the reach of all but a select few, and mobile data coverage is often expensive, slow, and patchy. In Zimbabwe, the lack of internet connectivity in some areas poses an increasing challenge, as over the last few years, the country has introduced a new e-curriculum in schools, promoting the adoption of new technologies in every aspect of education.
Yeah, Zimbabwe has been lagging in terms of internet connectivity and other modern things. Because there was an era which was too political, I can say. But this time around, with this new dispensation, they are accommodating everyone. They are saying less politics, but development front seat. This is what they are saying.
Farai Bishi sits at one of the 10 or so computers in Murambinda's only internet cafe. It is a converted shipping container situated in the heart of the town's market area. Farai is one of three brothers amongst other volunteers who set up the non-profit organization Murambinda Works in 2001 to provide internet connectivity to their community. They have also trained headmasters, teachers, hospital staff and local government officials in all things ICT. With a grant from the Internet Society, a non-profit organization that supports people who are getting their own communities online, they are also going to set up masts and antennas to beam signals from the Internet Cafe to schools as far as 40 kilometers away. Community networks like these are becoming viable alternatives to providing remote areas with fast and reliable internet. The networks are built using low-end equipment and are often owned and sustained by members of the community. Modern technologies are a must, explains Farai Bishi, even though he prefers his modest farm, an hour's walk from Murambinda, to his house in town. It's quiet and peaceful, he says, but due to the lack of electricity and internet coverage on his farm, he cannot spend as much time there as he would like to. He needs to be connected to do work for the Internet Cafe and Murambinda Works, and he wants to plant some new crops on his farm, for which he also needs the internet.
With the technology again, I want to plow some potatoes. I can do my research over the internet and to see how are they being grown. What kind of disease are they likely to be attacked in every stage up to their production. So I need the technology to plow on of the crop as well as to sell them. I will then advertise my product on the internet.
Access to knowledge and sharing of ideas is what motivated the 36-year-old to set up a community network.
Past times, we need to buy a newspaper to read. The newspapers from Harare. If we don't get a newspaper from Harare, then we run out of news. But these days, we are just getting worldwide news from the internet. And people like news. They want to hear what is happening in the world. Health-wise, want to search for good, healthy activities. For our kids, even for myself, the new curriculum of Zimbabwe, it is based on internet research.
To sustain their community network, the Bishi brothers plan to charge schools for connectivity, though at rates well below those of commercial providers. For those that cannot afford it, they plan to build revenue-generating fish ponds and gardens, monitored by so-called Internet of Things devices that will, for example, check water conditions and issue alerts at feeding times. Joseph Bishi, Farai's younger brother, explains that there will also be a hotspot around the container, and locals will be able to purchase vouchers, allowing them to access the Wi-Fi for a certain period of time. They also plan to offer private connections for homes and businesses. The 30-year-old believes that their project will also be an incentive for young people to stay in their community.
A lot of people, they really go after greener pastures. It's not bad, it's good for survival. But, you know, sometimes you need to be grateful to what you have received from the community. Just imagine, from my childhood, I was taught, I went to school, I learned how to appreciate certain things from that very community.
The Bishi brothers and Murambinda Works still have a long way to go, but they are confident that the perseverance that has brought them this far will also help them achieve their goal of connecting their remote community with the rest of the world. Joseph Bishi is convinced this project will not end in Murambinda and will inspire people all over the country.
That report was by Laura Salm-Reifferscheid with funding from the Internet Society. It was presented by Anke Raspa. You're listening to WorldLink with me, Kathleen Schuster. After the break, we've got a Christmas special for you, but first, time for some music. Welcome back to DW's WorldLink with me, Kathleen Schuster.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
That is the sound of Christmas, to me at least, maybe because I'm from the States and I've heard it in a million movies. So in that spirit, we're bringing you, in the second half of the show, stories of Christmas traditions, from Iceland to Jerusalem, many of which might not say Christmas to you, but they certainly say Christmas to someone. And we begin our journey in the Icelandic capital of Reykjavik. Now, Christmas in Iceland is the time of year when goblins sneak out of the mountains to cause mischief, and unlucky children could find themselves gobbled up by the Christmas cat. As Björn Malmquist reports, this stranger version of Christmas is making something
Hello!
Of a comeback.
Hello!
Hello!
Ah, the Christmas goblins. I remember being afraid of them when I was a kid. We have our own Christmas traditions here in Iceland, and they are more interesting than a jolly man dressed in red, even if they're sometimes scary. To explain all this, there is one name that springs to mind, an Englishman who has become an adopted son of Iceland, Brian Pilkington. Brian moved to Iceland in the 70s and began publishing children's books. Today, every man, woman, and child in Iceland will recognize his iconic illustrations of our Christmas traditions. We met beside a new statue in downtown Reykjavik, a statue of a cat.
The Yule cat in tradition is a large, oversized house cat that actually eats children if they don't get new clothes for Christmas, which has always seemed hugely unfair to me, that, you know, the children don't decide themselves what they get for Christmas. But if they don't get clothes for Christmas, the Christmas cat's going
to
eat them.
And according to the legend, he lives in the house of Grilla and Leppalúði, the two trolls that are the parents of these 13 rather strange Yule lads, or goblins, that we have here.
Yeah, right. And they're all of the same ilk. You know, the mother eats children as well. The Yule lads, 300 years ago, they started out as real nasty little demons, mm-hmm. and dressed in black. And over the centuries, they've changed. And now they're sort of more mischievous than anything else.
There are 13 Yule lads. Every year they descend from their home in the mountains and take turns to visit Iceland's children on each of the 13 nights before Christmas. Their names give clues to the strange mischief they get up to. Sausage stealer, door slammer, doorstep sniffer, window peeper, pot scraper.
The spoon lickers, lots of lickers, you know, the spoon licker and the bowl licker. And I guess it's all like little crimes that the children were accused of doing. And I think that, you know, the Yule cat thing was that the kids used to be involved in making of the clothes. And they had to sort of spin the wool and knit the socks and things. And if they didn't do it, they were going to get cold, you know, because Iceland was a fierce, unforgiving country back in the day.
And it still is.
It still is, yeah. We're standing here, and it's -6 if you're listening.
At the Árbær Open Air Museum on the outskirts of Reykjavik, 200 parents and children are dancing in circles around the Christmas tree. Leading the dancers are two Yule lads dressed in worn, rather dirty rags. Glukka Gjær, the one who peeks through windows, and Kjöt Krókur, the one who steals meat. I don't want you to think that we have never heard of Santa Claus. We have, but my feeling is that the old traditions are making a comeback. Maybe it's got something to do with the financial crash in 2008. Maybe we want to get back to our roots. I spoke to the director of the museum, Sigurlaugur Ingólfsson, to see what he thinks.
It seems to me that you're well and truly stuck in the past as far as the Christmas traditions here.
I think we are, and I think that's what people are after, I guess. For most of us who are older than 10, 11, 12, it brings back maybe the old Christmas of the past, and we want to come for that cozy feeling, I suppose, of you lads who are not very nice, who play tricks.
But this is sort of an antidote to the other westernized Christmas that we have actually become used to here in Iceland.
Yes, I mean, we try to avoid maybe the modern Christmas clichés, and it's fantastic how all the kids still know these songs, and it's something that's so kind of interwoven with Icelandic culture. It seems to be, it's probably going to stay forever, I suppose, and that's so fantastic about these things.
I think he's right, at least I hope he is. I mean, we like St. Nicholas with the white beard and the ho-ho-ho, but the Yule lads are just much more interesting characters, and it would really be a shame if we lost them from our collective memory. And with people like Brian Pilkington here to keep them alive, our strange traditions are in safe hands.
There's nobody can deny it's not strange. It's the weirdest Christmas, but wonderfully charming in its own way, you know. Like, and in many, many ways, it's much better than the Santa Claus. He only comes one night. We get 13 different nights.
This is Björn Malmquist for DW in Reykjavik, wishing a merry Icelandic Christmas to one and all.
The tradition of baking Christmas cookies is believed to date all the way back to the Celts, who on the longest night of the year, December 21st, sought to appease any evil spirits by offering them animal-shaped baked goods. Over time, this tradition evolved in Germany into a veritable national repertoire of sweetly spiced treats, which, as Tamsin Walker's Adventures in the Festive Kitchen go to show, extends way beyond butter, flour, and sugar.
In der Weihnachtsbäckerei gibt es manche Leckerei. Zwischen Mehl und Milch macht so mancher Knecht eine riesengroße Kleckerei. In der Weihnachtsbäckerei, in der Weihnachtsbäckerei. Wo ist das Rezept?
I have this book, a slip of a volume called Weihnachtsplätzchen, or Christmas Cookies, given to me a few years ago by my eldest daughter. As a hint, perhaps, an expression of hope, or just an answer to the silent cry for help that my hapless baking hand has been stirring into the festive mix for as long as any of us can remember. Each year, when the Advent season takes hold here, and every German I do and don't know seems to be whipping up Christmas biscuits in an instinctive, almost primal way, the book, whose cover is given over to perfectly formed morsels that are very much out of my league, gives me a knowing wink. And every year, I ignore it, opting instead for an easy Christmas cookies internet search. I don't think I've ever used the same easy recipe twice, but even so, my biscuit offerings almost invariably come out gently blackened around the edges and tasting like hard sugared cardboard. You could say I belong to the nailed it school of bakery. This year, though, after listening to a couple of my neighbours talk about the many, as in up to 25 different kinds of biscuits they produce with their families each year, I decided to up my game, or at least try, with the help of a certain slip of a volume.
These were the Timmy Daddy you wanted to make, didn't you?
Yeah.
So on the first Sunday in December, my kids and I, because this business of biscuit making is apparently best done in cheerful company, rolled up our sleeves to get cracking. Except there wasn't much cracking to be done, because I'd forgotten the eggs and the almonds, which seemed to be a staple in the German Plätzchen that people here have been baking for hundreds of years. The shops were shut, so I improvised.
Pull the rest in. No, I'm just making this one up. It's probably going to be awful. Look, I'm making blobs. No, you can't mix glue, you haven't done any of the work.
What was the work?
Here, making these blobs.
How does it work to make blobs?
Oh, well, they'll make themselves. Fine art of blob making.
In the end, they did lick the spoon and the pot. But the blobs themselves remain at the bottom of the biscuit tin. I tried. The next attempt was better, in that the dough got made, rolled, and cut out. We may have taken some presentation liberties, deviating slightly from the prescribed circles neatly dusted with icing sugar to create pink donkeys, purple reindeer and orange polar bears. A menagerie that might leave you thinking I'd given up on my self-set challenge of rising to the heights of real German Christmas baking. But how wrong you'd be, for by then I had eggs and almonds. And everything else the book told me I needed for one of the nation's favourites. Cinnamon stars, which were allegedly first recorded as a thing in the 1500s. They're all soft, nutty and cinnamony with a pristine sugar and egg white icing. In theory, at least.
Have one. Have a burnt biscuit. God, I need a hammer to get through it.
No, you don't.
How delish.
How do they make it so that it's just pure white icing in the book?
Fake it.
Truth be told, I'd forgotten they were in the oven. So mine came out more beige than white. And at that point, I decided to bow out and leave the kitchen to one of my daughters who had her mind and heart set on making gingerbread men. I did her the favour of staying well away until she lured me back with the smell of warm spices. She seemed to have everything completely under control, but I had a peek into the oven just to be sure.
How's it doing?
Good.
Can I have a look?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, look at that.
They looked as good as they smelled. A dozen perfectly formed gingerbread men stared up at me as if happy to have been made by someone other than me. So I slid their tray back into the oven and left my daughter to it. Only I'd also left my mark. I'm not quite sure how, but in that one moment of involvement, that single movement, I managed to decapitate the entire back row of her cheerful chaps. Oh dear.
Bye-bye.
I've since closed my slip of a volume and put it back on the shelf for another year. Quite possibly longer. And I thought everyone at my place would have had enough of baking for a while. But when my gingerbread-loving, good-humoured daughter came home yesterday, she asked me, with genuine delight, to guess what she'd volunteered to make for her class Christmas party. Yes, let's just say she must be a glutton for punishment. Or maybe she's the answer to that silent cry for help my hapless baking hand seems certain to continue stirring into any future festive mix.
Many thanks to our WorldLink columnist Tamsin Walker in Berlin. If you've heard Christmas bell music, say at a church, then what you were hearing might have been a carillon. A carillon is a system of bells that are hooked up to a keyboard, and playing the keys makes the bells ring. It's a common sound in Christian countries, and as it turns out, there's also one of these in the Middle East, at Jerusalem's YMCA, in fact. It's the only one in the Middle East. And there's also only one person in the city who can play it, a Jewish psychoanalyst. Iris Machler has this report from Jerusalem.
In the 1930s, it was dubbed a sermon in stone, and the new YMCA building quickly became one of Jerusalem's landmarks. Designed by the architect of New York's Empire State Building, it was constructed at huge cost to promote peace among the religions fighting here. For decades, its tower was the tallest in Jerusalem. It's been overtaken now, but it still has something unique in the Middle East: carillon bells. Today, the man who plays the carillon is up in the belfry, his eyes not on the breathtaking view. He's busy cleaning the bells with a broom. See, I didn't realise they were so varied in size.
Yes.
There's some baby bells.
This is the baby bell. This is the big brother. And this is a new cousin. This is the new one.
This is the new bell.
And all the rest are relatives.
Gabby Scheffler has been playing here since he was a student. That's on and off for around 45 years. And he still loves the sound.
When you don't have any wind in the summer, it just drops like, you know, like a good whiskey or a good chocolate. The make is a Gillett & Johnson. It's a British make, one of the best. This is really the Stradivarius of Carillons. They have very special sound, very British, you know. Basso profundo. This is the playing room.
There are three keyboards here, one for playing, one for practicing, and a new one that can record.
It's not a machine, it's a clavier. Imagine a clavier made for a hippopotamus or an elephant playing on four heads. So you need to have very thick fingers in order to clap those.
Scheffler's connection to the Y goes back to when he was a boy and learnt to swim in the pool here. Then his children were among the first to go to the Y's binational Arab and Israeli kindergarten. But still, playing the carillon was unexpected. How did you... You're a psychotherapist.
Yes, I'm a psychotherapist and a psychoanalyst. It was actually just by chance. They had here a course, a three-month course. They published it on the press and I saw the ad. I was haunted.
The carillon bells. First of all, do you like them?
I love them. Are you kidding? Love them.
That's Dvorah Berger, veteran YMCA guide and spokesperson. She says she hadn't really thought about the fact that the man playing the Christmas bells is Jewish.
That is hilarious. That's great. That's very funny. Never thought about it.
Really, you never thought about it?
I thought about how many Jews work on Christmas. That I did. Actually, we were decorating the tree, and at one point it was me and this Muslim guy. And I said, a Jewish girl and a Muslim guy are decorating the Christmas tree.
But she says the mix is characteristic of this place, from the kindergarten to the gym.
So you go to a Zumba class. You look in this class and you have no idea who's Muslim, Christian, Jewish, diplomat, cleaner, whatever. They're all just doing Zumba, having fun. That's the YMCA.
For 80 years, the YMCA had a secret. For all that time, their carillon was one bell short, with 35 instead of 36 bells. Gabby Scheffler speculates that that was a cost-cutting measure back in the 1930s. But it's finally been put right. The YMCA sent all the musical machinery, except the bells, to Holland to be repaired. And the Dutch company sent everything back, in better condition, with one extra bell, an 825-kilo donation from them to the YMCA.
And Mr. Eichsbaut, the owner, had his appreciation to this carillon, and they donated the
wow.
Bell. And we are very thankful for that.
For a year while the carillon was being repaired, the bells fell silent. Scheffler says he's been surprised by how much people missed them. The sound had become a part of their lives, during Christmas and Easter, and also on summer evenings. Now the bells have been returned, just in time for this Christmas, and the public is thrilled.
Wonderful. Exceptional.
What makes it special, do you think?
Because it's the bells. It's not an ordinary piano or guitar. It's bells.
Because it's very old, so you can actually listen to how old it is and also listen to the music that is new, and at the same time, it's just heartwarming. You can feel it in your heart, actually.
Of course, I like it very, very much. They remember me, the history of the area, especially our country, Palestine, with all religions. And I appreciate these bells, yes, always.
People are here always worried about terror attacks, and it's difficult here. I won't hide it. But on the other hand, there are very beautiful things and sights, and one of these is here, and people can really take a sort of time out or time in, or zoom out or zoom in, and enjoy.
It's Christmas with bells on at the YMCA. Iris Makler, DW, Jerusalem.
When you think of Christmas in Germany, it's probably something like this. Very traditional, white Christmas, meat and potatoes, etc. And there's one more beloved holiday phenomenon here, and that's the Christmas market. It's what makes the downtown smell like cinnamon and cloves, and its popularity attracts so many people that even a quiet city like Bonn has something on par with a real nightlife for one solid month a year, at least until 10 p.m. I like it, but I'll admit I kind of don't get how this became so popular. So I met up with cultural anthropologist Dagmar Henne down the road at a local Christmas market to finally get some answers.
I have to admit, I've been dying to ask you the question all week. Why do people choose to stand out in the cold in December when it's gray?
Well, I don't know.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, links durch Eis und Schnee. Morgen kommt der Weihnachtsmann, kommt dort von der Höhe.
Well, we were talking about this before the interview, actually, of kind of the difference between your private life in Germany and like where you share space with other people. Could you tell us a little bit about that for people who maybe never have been to Germany, what that has to do with the Christmas market?
Well, what I think is my experience as a German, if you go to other countries all around the world, people invite you to their home in their private space. In Germany, you invite people only if you know them very well, if they are family or if they're really good friends. But you also want to meet people you like, but you are not in a very deep friendship with. So you meet outside, you meet in the public sphere.
Let's talk about some other things that you typically see here. I mean, for me, a typical Christmas market, you have to have Glühwein, you have to have Lebkuchen or gingerbread, and probably some sort of meat to eat.
Glühwein is a very, very old European tradition. It, also the Roman cook their wines, make it hot, sweet it with honey and with spices.
And for people who don't know, it's typically red wine with cloves and cinnamon and orange. And you can make it at home, but you can also go outside and drink it. And I don't know about you, but I haven't been able to drink it that much this month because it's been so warm. But today it's freezing outside, so I think it's kind of a perfect day to have Glühwein.
Yes, it is. If it's too warm, it's just does not taste. There was only a very short period, only some minutes, when it's the perfect temperature to drink. It's before it's too hot, you will burn your tongue, and after, if it's too cold, it does not taste anymore.
I can only confirm this from experience.
Wir trinken immer gleich 10 Tassen. Er kann es nun mal nicht lassen.
Ja, Prost. I think you're right. It's not exactly the best tasting thing, but it warms you up just right. That's probably the only reason why I would drink this. Let's talk a little bit more about what we're seeing here. So it's an illuminated Christmas market. You have these little huts, basically these stands where they sell everything. You can get Christmas gifts, you can get ornaments for your tree, and you smell all of these wonderful spices in the air. Like you said, it smells like Christmas. And one, I have to say, probably my favorite smell is of candied almonds. And so they're kind of these caramelized almonds that are nothing that any dentist would really like to see that you've been eating, but they're wonderful. And where does that tradition come from? Because almonds aren't native to Germany.
Yeah, almonds are not native here in Germany, but they are also since the medieval ages, they are very popular. They had been very expensive, of course. They had to be transported from the world. And they get cheaper in the 19th century. And to put sugar around it to make it this crunchy, it also conserves the almond. So you can just have them longer.
In my experience, they don't last very long, but that's a nice thought. So I've been thinking a lot about what makes German Christmas markets German. And to me, what seems German about it is more how similar it is to other really common rituals in everyday life. So it's really common here for people to kind of make a ritual out of, let's go get a cup of coffee, let's have a nice conversation, let's have a piece of cake. And it's very much about creating a little atmosphere with just the simplest way of enjoying your time with other people. And to me, Christmas markets are very much an extension of that. Do you agree or do you see it differently?
I think it's a little bit ambivalent. On the one hand, you're absolutely right. It's a very easy way to meet, to come together, to have this feeling of community. What is very important on all those rituals we do in everyday life. And you pay the feeling of standing outside, getting cold, and it's in an atmosphere of coziness. It's cute. The Christmas markets and all those traditions around Advent, they were so popular in our not very religious society. For me, it seems to be that this symbolic idea of family, of coming together, of having community, and communication is still very important for our society. And, well, I like this idea.
Christmas lights have revolutionized the art of competition when it comes to Christmas decorations. Just ask John Phillips. He's been lighting up his corner of Southwest England for the past 20 years with Christmas cheer. What started with just a few lights has evolved into an extravaganza of music, laser projectors, and illuminated Santas. Kurt Brooks has this report from Devon in Southwest England.
I normally do my planning when I'm in bed trying to sleep, because obviously you got work, you're watching telly, and this, that, and the other. And the only time I can really sort of think about things is when I'm in bed and thinking about, I've got a set of lights, that's going to go there, this is going to go there, would that look nice there, what else are the sets have I got up in the loft?
Putting a few decorations up at Christmas is nothing out of the ordinary in the UK, but 61-year-old John Phillips from Bear Alston, a small village in rural Devon, takes it to another level entirely.
Loads of twinkly lights. I've got some stars that's hanging up in one of the trees and this, and that. I've got lights that are all on the ground with some of the ornaments of Father Christmas's reindeers.
John's two-storey family home is by no means a mansion and is similar to many of the average family houses along England's southwest coast, with one big difference. For the last 25 years, he's been obsessed with turning it into a mammoth Christmas lights display.
Some gnomes, Father Christmas, and Mrs. Christmas, little sleigh out there with some teddies on, and just, you know, just little touches like that, just showing my creative side.
Not to mention the projectors, sound system, and of course, the flashing reindeer.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop.
Most of John's neighbours seem content with the odd Christmas wreath and perhaps some coloured fairy lights around the door and front window. John, on the other hand...
I was aiming for 12,000, but I had one or two sort of long sections go. I got lights, spare lights up in the loft, so I brought them down and connected them up. So I think all they're going now is it's got to be about 14,000 up there now.
John's decorations really are a sight to behold. Apart from the thousands of lights on display, John has several laser projectors in his garden casting festive patterns onto the side of his house. And he doesn't stop there. In the upstairs window, there are moving images of Father Christmas and his reindeer wishing passers-by a Merry Christmas, an effect John achieves by linking multiple projectors and speakers to two constantly running DVD players.
Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey.
So, how did it all begin?
Years ago, we didn't have very much money in this city. I only had one or two little fairy lights years ago when I was a little kiddie and whatever. And then it all started off years ago. We had one sort of Santa and that looked quite nice. And our next door neighbour had a Santa and some other lights. And me being slightly sort of competitive, I thought, oh, I'll have to beat that.
These types of huge domestic displays are still relatively uncommon in England, although the trend has been growing for the last few decades, perhaps because of the ever-increasing commercialism around Yuletide. Some people find them vulgar, but for John, it's such an important tradition, he even sacrifices 5 days of his annual holiday allowance to it.
You can't do it out in the rain. And when you come home from work and have dinner and all that, and if you've got electrics out, you've got to undo all the boxes. It's just time-consuming. So if you can do it all in 1 week and leave all the boxes out in that day and whatever and plan it all out, it makes my job a little bit easier.
John's wife, Tracy, who describes herself as a Christmas widow, helps in her own special way by keeping her distance during the holiday madness. A distance of nearly 300 miles, in fact.
My mother lives two doors down, so we went up to Peterborough where my sister lives. So that gave him plenty of time to get on with the lights, and he had most of them done, thank goodness, before I came home.
And I know what you're thinking. With over 14,000 lights and everything else running from November until the beginning of January, how much does it cost to run?
What does it do to our electricity bill, dear? It works out to about £2, £2.50 a night. And mainly the only thing that sort of takes the electricity up is the sort of two projectors upstairs and the two DVD players, because obviously they're running all the time.
That's between two and three times more than average, but it's all for a good cause. Any spectators are asked to make a contribution to his charity collection for the baby unit at Derriford Hospital, where he works as a ward domestic assistant.
So I've done the baby care unit before, but two or three years ago. I think I raised it £250. They were pleased with that then. I haven't finished yet, so I'm looking for about £500 or just more. I'll be happy with that.
After 25 years of his mammoth displays, John has decided that this year's will be his last. Is his long-suffering wife Tracy looking forward to the prospect?
Yeah, and the warmth, you know, the doors won't be kept open quite so long and the cold air coming through all the time, so it'd be a lot warmer.
Nevertheless, John's neighbour Justine thinks he'll struggle not to get the lights out again next year.
I think he'll keep it going. He said it's going to lessen, he just wants to sort of like cut down on it all, but to be fair, it's absolutely beautiful. And if you look upstairs and you look down, it's just stunning, absolutely stunning. He puts a lot of effort into it, we watch him. Do it for, well, a good month before, and he spends hours and hours out there in the rain, in the wind, nailing it all down and making it all nice. I hope he keeps carrying it on, I really do.
Anyone in the area looking for some Christmas cheer will be able to see John's festive display until around the second week in January, and they should be easy enough to find. As John jokes.
More likely to be able to see it from space, actually, so I've been told.
This is Kurt Brooks for DW in Devon, England.
And that wraps up this week's edition of WorldLink. If you have any feedback or questions regarding the programme, just drop us a line at worldlink@dw.com. In the meantime, you can always listen back to this and past episodes at dw.com/worldlink on SoundCloud or on iTunes. You can also connect with us via our DW Global Society Facebook page. This week's WorldLink was produced by Neil King and me, Kathleen Schuster. Our studio engineer was Christoph Grove. We wish you all peace and joy during this holiday season. Thanks for listening and tune in again next week. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.